Your dad was John McCain.
Yes. My dad was a huge music fan. I'm going to tell you right now, my dad loved Willie Nelson. And people are like, you can't say you liked Willie Nelson because he dodged his taxes, blah, blah, blah. Well, he loved Willie Nelson. He did.
Everybody thinks they can do it. How can I become a professional wrestler? You really can't.
I pulled out the gun and I shot two times.
We have a complicated family. We were all raised to argue with each other with intensity, with passion, but also to love each other.
This is WTMJ Conversations.
Welcome to WTMJ Conversations. I'm your host, Libby Collins. Michael Murphy is a singer, songwriter. He plays instruments, and he also produces music. He was born in Neenah, but he's based now in Nashville. He released his debut solo project called Indigo Jones, which was influenced by time he spent in London and experiencing all that culture across the pond. And Michael's here with us today. Michael, you grew up in Neenah. You had a couple brothers.
Yes.
Were you guys the musical family?
We were. And still to this day, any chance we get, it's always an opportunity to play. Anytime we're together, music is happening. It's
right.
Great.
So how old were you when you first got involved in music? And I don't know, were you the guy who led it, or did one of your other brothers get this all started?
Well, for the family band itself, it was a brainchild of my brother and I. We had gotten the Beatles Rock Band video game on the Wii from a Craigslist ad in like one of the northern suburbs of Chicago. And we were playing through it and we looked at each other and we said, I think we can figure this out because it's so entertaining. So our mom went out and got the beginner like Beatles piano book and guitar book. And we had gotten for Christmas, our neighbor was a district attorney and had hinted that a client had to put up instruments for collateral at a pawn shop. And so our first instruments were a hint from our neighbor to get these pawn shop instruments. So we were learning the Beatles on pawn shop instruments and kind of figured it out that way. So for the first like 4 years, the family band was exclusively doing Beatles.
How old were you at the time?
I was, I believe, 10 or 11, because I remember my younger brother would have been right around like six or seven, playing drums.
And how old was your older brothers?
Older brother would have been 12 or 13 when we started doing
this. Did you dress up as the Beatles?
For a while, we bought the very incorrect colors, but the spirit was there of the very much made in China silk and could probably like melt if it was near an open flame version of the Sergeant Pepper's coats. Because we did that for Halloween 1 year, and then it kind of expanded. We had considered going to the level of, like, the matching haircut, the matching suits, the matching instruments, but we were kind of more involved in just, like, the music of learning all of the language within the Beatles music than we were kind of doing the shtick, which has definitely carried on to what we were able to do now. I think if we stayed dressing like the Beatles, I would still be wearing an outfit of theirs to this day, but luckily, we weren't pigeonholed to the Beatles' outfits.
Yeah, there's three of you brothers,
of
but who was the fourth Beatle?
We kind of faked it. And Jack, for a while, I would basically kind of have to hybrid the two guitar parts. And so that actually was a great way to learning how to play, because I was trying to pick and choose between John and George guitar parts and piece it together. And my brother primarily was actually just playing bass. My older brother had just learned how to play bass. So he was our bassist for a while. We found a Hofner at a music store in Neenah that was somewhat close enough, and so he was learning all those bass parts, and then we were taking at this time lessons at the YMCA in Neenah. All of our music lessons were done at the YMCA in Neenah. Our mom is a classically trained violinist, so that was kind of her dream, was to have a string quartet. So I actually, my first instrument that I played was the cello, and my older brother is a violinist, and we still to this day play those instruments. And so she desperately wanted us to be doing string quartet music and all the Bach music.
She wanted to do chamber music.
She did. And then we realized that, like, for weddings, it was great because we could have the ceremony with the string quartet and then the band afterwards, because all we wanted to do as kids was we just wanted to play the rock music. So that was way more fun for us.
How old were you when you got your first paycheck for working as a musician?
Probably 9 or 10. And it was interesting because we definitely had a lot of family discussions and dilemmas of, like, how much do we dive into this versus how much do we let the boys stay kids. Like, that was the big thing. So we really, in theory, could have done way more earlier and done the whole child star approach of things. But my mom, and I'm so grateful for this, my parents both were like, let them be kids. That honestly led to our love, especially my older brother and I still do this professionally. That kind of led to the love that we have for it, because we didn't really recognize that what we were doing at the time was a family business, or that it was hustle, or that it was learning all this new stuff. And we just loved playing music, and the paycheck was a bonus on the side. We were like, this is so cool that we get to just play stuff that we want to play, that we would normally be playing in our pajamas, that we get to do in front of people. And now money's associated. So that really helped, like, fast forward into now. It's like my association with music is still like this childhood love for it, where it's hard for me to get burnt out because there's just so much to do that I haven't done yet, that it keeps it always fresh and interesting, which is great.
When did you move away from the Beatles? Because I'm thinking by the time you got into high school, that probably wasn't that
for sure.
Cool.
Yeah, so we would still do it, because then by that point, Jack and I were definitely interested in other things. But then also, so like most of the Beatles stuff that we would do would be like, okay, the few dance tunes that everyone is like, if you're playing a private event or if you're playing a wedding or something like that, that somebody's like, oh, play something we can dance to. Then you immediately go to the Twist and Shout era Beatles and stuff. But by the time we got into high school, it was like the amount of indie rock influences and stuff. Like at that point, I'd gotten into this band called the Revivalists out of New Orleans. And they are still to this day one of my top favorite bands that I really enjoy listening to. And that kind of opened the door for me for arranging, because at that point, too, in high school, I was doing a lot more jazz. Up until that point, I wasn't jazz. I was like strictly a classical player that would do rock on the side. So then when I opened the door for learning jazz guitar, but then just the genre as a whole with what the instruments were capable of doing, that made it easier. So I got into the band at the time, and these old Americana bands that were playing with horns. So I would
like
arrange.
Which ones?
So the band with the big one. And that one was a really interesting one to approach, because all of those horn parts were for the most part written by Alan Toussaint. And so there's not straightforward. And so I was listening to stuff that was not straightforward, not intuitive, but I really liked it. And that applied to then what I ended up writing. So I kind of had a high school band in the sense that like I had a jazz combo and we'd play straight ahead jazz, but then I would book little things around, especially at like our high school would have certain events. So I'd book the band, and so I'd be playing rock songs with like a 4-piece horn section. And I was writing all those parts by hand in my little manuscript paper that I'd gotten from the school. So I was like, that opened my door for like learning all the arranging things. And I was still in orchestra playing the cello. I was doing jazz band. I was in choir. So I was just like constantly doing music all the time. For me, it was like anytime I hated doing sitting down and like reading my history homework, doing everything like that, which sounds so cliche, but it's like I was most of the time thinking about random horn arrangements, or like, oh, it'd be sick if somebody could learn this clarinet part. And like I would arrange a whole thing and it would like never happen. So I'm like still sitting on arrangements that have never been played that will hopefully get played someday.
When you're supposed to be doing your algebra.
When I'm supposed to be doing algebra. Yeah, I was not a good geometry student, but I really liked arranging horn parts. It was so fun. So much more fun.
Coming up on WTMJ Conversations.
I was actually eating tamales at the dean at the time's house. And I was like, I just asked him, I was like, I'm curious if there's any recording anything.
Singer-songwriter Michael Murphy tells us why he changed his college major from neuroscience.
Now, more of WTMJ Conversations.
Welcome back. I'm Libby Collins. We're talking with singer-songwriter from Neenah, Michael Murphy. So I would assume then, by the time you graduated from high school, you knew music was your future.
Funny enough, originally when I was applying for schools, was looking at, wow, this is so I need money to live a nice, long life-oriented approach, but I was originally touring schools for pre-med and neuroscience. So all my application essays and everything like that was, let me do neuroscience. I originally went to Lawrence to study neuroscience, and the second I got there, I was like, well, I'm paying for school by playing music. I keep trying to add myself and insert myself in various bands in the scene and everything like that. What am I really doing? And how it was set up with the school is my degree from that school is a Bachelor of Musical Arts. And that program had started the year I went there. That was a huge reason I went there, because it was like, okay, I can blend music, but I can also do another straight ahead degree and split 50% in the college, 50% in the conservatory. But how it just works because of scheduling, you can't do any college classes until you take the prereqs of the conservatory, because there's just so much to do. And then that immediately changed my trajectory. And I was actually eating tamales at the dean at the time's house. He was having like a small get-together tamale party. And I went there and I was like, I just asked him, I was like, I'm curious if there's any recording anything at the school currently. And he's like, well, we just hired a guy that's kind of taking over and spearheading a new recording department. Because at that point, there was a big transition. Larry Darling, who was there forever, had left. And so my then professor for audio engineering, I basically got to be a guinea pig and completely switched everything I was doing. I was diving in headfirst into jazz guitar. I ended up getting a self-design thing in business and production. And then I was also taking any lessons I could at the time. So I did upright and electric bass at the school. I did classical voice, and I did as much as I could for lessons just because why not?
Your classical voice teacher is pretty well known.
Pretty well known. I was very, very fortunate to have studied with John Holliday. I mean, actually, Jack, my older brother, we were both very lucky to have studied with John. And my brother's degree is in music ed and voice. So he was with John for basically every semester for all 4 years. I only had overlap at the beginning with John, and then I had a brief stint in the middle where I was just taking a bunch of different lessons on different instruments, and then kind of was like, okay, I kind of see what the end game is of what I'm trying to accomplish with this. It makes sense for me to go back in, and of course it makes sense for me if I'm trying to do pop rock to, you know, be singing Italian arias. That is the logical next step. And so that was what I was doing. We would do these voice area recitals at Lawrence. Like, it was like once a term you would do a voice area recital. And so teachers would select which students would go sing and in front of all of the voice faculty and the students. And so at this point, everyone had known me as Michael, the jazz guitarist. So like everyone just knew. I was like, oh, yeah, he's the guy that he sings rock stuff sometimes. And he's a guitarist. He studies guitar here. And then I would like go up and sing some Italian piece or some very obscure English art song that's like a take on sonnets by Shakespeare. So it was really fun to have that in my back pocket. But a lot of the classical voice came from all three of the Murphy boys were all in the Appleton Boy Choir growing up. And so that was what opened the door for us to honestly understand what we could do with music, because we had all traveled around the world actually singing. And so my older brother did South Africa, and then he and I together, we did a tour with a choir in Ireland. I went on and did a tour in Peru. My younger brother went to Iceland and sang. And then all of us went back as alum and sang with the choir in Greece a few years ago. So that to us was like second nature of like, of course, if you do it well, you can go out and play. So it's like, again, we shout out to the Fox Cities and our parents, especially for like masking the what is actual on paper work of this as like, it just for us seemed like the fun thing to do at the time, which really made it special.
Coming up on WTMJ Conversations.
The reason I was so drawn to London was because I can do the college classes that I need to get done, but I can also fly with my guitar on my back and dive headfirst into the scene in the area.
Singer-songwriter Michael Murphy talks about his time playing music across the pond.
You're listening to WTMJ Conversations.
I'm your host, Libby Collins. Let's return to our conversation with singer-songwriter Michael Murphy. When you were still in college, you ended up in London.
I did, yes.
And were you playing there? Or how did that all come about, and what did you end up doing?
Yeah, I lucked out that I had a lot of college classes to take. So I was like, what better way? Also, one of Lawrence's requirements is you have to have something where you either are taking a world language class on campus or you can get the credit by just going to another country. So I'm like, I'm going to go to another country. And the reason I was so drawn to London was because I can do the college classes that I need to get done, but I can also fly with my guitar on my back and just dive headfirst into the scene in the area. Because I was living where the campus is, where we stay is technically attached to. We basically mooched off of Florida State has a campus there. So our school rents a flat from them, but we do all of the classes in the same building as these Florida State kids. But then we have one of the buildings, the top floor is just for Lawrence. So I was taking mostly anthropology and history classes. And then after class is done, then I would grab my guitar and go into the city because I was in Soho, basically. So there's theaters everywhere. There's music stores everywhere. So I was about, in English measurements, I was half a kilometer away from Denmark Street. And that historically was the spot where David Bowie slept in his car on the street there when he was starting out and kind of throwing around ideas for demos for Space Oddity and for everything off the Hunky Dory album. And the Stones recorded there, and all these other bands were recording in these theaters, and now all of them have turned into pretty iconic vintage music stores. And all of the people that run it are 30-something-year-old English hipsters that play rock and roll. So I would go there at least twice a week just to hang out with the music store employees in the secret back rooms or anywhere and just jam on stuff. And people were sending me demos of stuff, and I would go back, and we had this one practice room in the basement where I would like go through on my phone and record some stuff and bring it to the store the next day and be like, check this out, is it? And we would jam on stuff. And so a lot of Indigo Jones, actually pretty much every single demo of that album came from my time there, and then I completed it right when I got back to the States, including one of the songs on the album. I had written part of a song, and my brother had written part of a song in a practice room in New York, because at this point he was doing his master's at NYU, and we came back together around Christmas break, and back to the days when we were playing pajamas, we were jamming on these two ideas that we had both written in different time zones and different countries, and ended up piecing together my favorite song on the album that I've been playing the most all over.
Still ahead on WTMJ Conversations.
The album for me is like, what would I want to be playing on stage right now? And then I just hash out what my brain feels like it wants to do.
Singer-songwriter Michael Murphy talks about the inspiration for his new album.
Now, more of WTMJ Conversations.
And I'm Libby Collins. Our guest today is singer-songwriter from Neenah, Michael Murphy.
Just to back up,
yeah.
It's Indigo Jones. That is your debut album.
That is my debut album.
And
yeah.
It's heavily influenced by a lot of these English musicians.
Oh, for sure. At this point, I was listening to so much early Elton John, so much Zeppelin, and then a lot of like the band Television. I was listening to a lot of, like, they had the single Marquee Moon that I keep forgetting is like 11 minutes long, and it just like, it's one of those songs that you're like, have I listened to this on repeat, or is, oh no, they just wrote 17 verses for this song, and it's the same thing. But I was listening to a lot of like these weird classic rock bands that were definitely heavily influenced by the American blues and the Americana scene, but then also these like kind of indie pre-baby synthesizer era British bands. And so that, it's like, the album for me is like, and this kind of has now been my writing approach for most of the new stuff I've been working on. It's like, I write to play what I want to play. So like, I have so much music in my head for the years of just all the stuff I've learned for various bands I've played with, that certain songs give me certain feelings of things that bring me joy, like little guitar licks that I'm like, oh, that's awesome, I like playing this song because of this one thing. Or like certain melody hooks, I'm like, I love singing this because of this one specific thing. So my writing approach basically has taken that of like, what do I want to be playing? And so I just get to get in the headspace of like, what would I want to be playing on stage right now? And then I just hash out what my brain feels like it wants to do. And so that's really what happened, was I was just exposed to so much British music, so much British rock from 1969 to 74 was almost all I was listening to. And then it just became this album, and I just kept writing. It ended up being 13 songs, and I had to cut like 7 of them. They'll be on something else at some point, but yeah, it was a mess. It was a mess.
So you ended up in London, but then you came back.
I came back.
And finished school.
Finished school, yep, in 2023.
And at that point, your brother was in New York, and he's a professional musician as well. Did you think, okay, I'm going to go to New York? Because there are certain places in the country where if you're going to be a performer, you want to be.
For sure. And I was there a lot, and I still am there a lot. And I have like a little pocket of musicians that I play with often in the city. So for a while, I was there like once a month. And I actually met my girlfriend through my brother through grad school because of being in the city. So I'm there all the time. And I'm in the fun dilemma right now of being 24 and figuring out how much of one city is calling me all the time, where I'm like, where am I going?
Well, and that's the interesting thing too, because technically you are based in Nashville.
Yes.
Which is a real music mecca.
Phenomenal, phenomenal scene. Yes.
Since you alluded so much to that music from between 69 and 74, didn't the Lovin' Spoonful have a song about how many guitar pickers were in Nashville?
Yes, they did. And I believe Steve Marshall and I were talking about that song when I was driving back from Nashville the other day. The scene is also getting so different. The thing that I love about Nashville is that I can load up a car with nothing but instruments. Like, I just got back from Nashville, and it was, my car had a full PA system, a whole drum set, a bass piano, guitar. Oh, yeah.
Keyboard.
Yes.
Not a Steinway.
Not a Steinway. A keyboard. Various guitars and stuff where I'm like, there is no way anything else other than instruments can fit in this car. And there were still stuff I was missing. But that has been great because in Nashville, it's like I am in utility mode. Like I play pedal steel, banjo, mandolin, anything that I can get called for. There's a band that I just started playing with where I'm playing just banjo and cello with them. And then another artist I play mandolin and guitar with. And so it's like I have my collection of stuff because I can drive around with a car full of instruments. And then it's just like, oh, what's needed? And I just can pull it out of the trunk. New York, I have to be a little more selective because it's all what you can fit on your back that can fit on the A train that won't get stolen from you. So it's an awesome scene because it's a completely different approach to stuff. It's like there I fly out with a thing on my back with whatever I can pull in to make it sound like how I need it to sound. And then I show up to the venue and play.
Is the community different? In other words, the musicians that you're playing with and their goals.
Mm-hmm.
And their energy and what they want to do. Is it different versus London, New York, Nashville? Or are musicians all kind of the same guy?
It's a combo of both. At the end of the day, we are all trying to fight the same animal. But there is inherently different characteristics of each thing. And it was actually when I was learning, kind of deep diving into production, where I really learned that. Because on paper, there is literally differences in the engineering approach between each city, and that also creates the appeal of why people are drawn to certain cities. In the modern day, you can do anything from anywhere now, so it kind of defeats the purpose. Because at the end of the day, I really have to be living in a place that is close enough to an airport where if I get a call, I can immediately find a way to get to wherever I'm getting called to play. And that has kind of changed now as modern, because as long as you have an internet connection, you can do so much work in various capacities.
Coming up on WTMJ Conversations.
At the end of the day, if you are a good person, that goes a very long way.
Singer-songwriter Michael Murphy tells us what it takes to make it in Nashville and why he's a good hang.
You're listening to WTMJ Conversations.
Welcome back to our conversation with singer-songwriter Michael Murphy from Nina. I'm your host, Libby Collins. To make it as a performer,
yeah,
to really get on a big stage, a major stage, you're all talented.
Yes.
You all can do
similar
things. Many are more talented than others, but it's really who you know.
For sure.
So where do you make the best contacts?
Oh, man. That is such a great question. Yeah, there right now, Nashville is the city for me that's been just lighting up. And a lot of that has happened in the last, like, I look at just the last calendar year of what I've been fortunately able to do. And what I thought would be the end goal for a year, what I thought would be the end goal for next year, and stuff changes. And yeah, Nashville, all of a sudden, a bunch of opportunities pop up, and you're like, I have to be down here. My goal is to basically kind of consolidate how many cities I'm split between to expand the bubble there. Because with the big music cities especially, there's a common thread that you have to be there long enough to build the web of connections, to go to the club hangs, to show up to the jams, to show up to other people's set, to be a, you know, to be not only a musician hunting for things, but also to be a friend. Like that, at the end of the day, if you are a good person, that goes a very long way. It's usually that's the hierarchy of needs for hiring, is if you are a fun hang, that goes way further than how many degrees you have.
Describe
stuff.
A fun hang. What do you mean by that?
Yeah, if you are a person that could get along with the band, that can gel, chemistry is everything, and you can have some of the coolest bands with, I mean, say a modern thing, but use probably a very old example, but the band Blind Faith did one tour and one album, and on paper had the craziest bout of musicians. I mean, Steve Winwood, Eric Clapton, and Ginger Baker were all playing in a band together, but that only lasted a year. And all of that kind of went to the band's fundamental happiness, because Clapton really loved the band, as do I, and couldn't get it to sound exactly like that, and that defeated him. And ultimately,
and Ginger Baker was a little high maintenance.
A little high maintenance. I mean, a little, yeah. For anyone who hasn't seen that documentary of Beware of Mr. Baker, the most eye-opening thing to, I mean, times were so different back then for music lessons. This is what I gathered from that. He is something else. But opportunities have come for me truly based on good, solid friendships. And that's the best part, because I love getting called from people that I genuinely want to be around. And honestly, a lot of it, it's like, if they're just starting out too, you don't even factor the pay end of it, because you're too busy being like, this is the most fun I've had playing with a band. And there's a band that I play with down in Nashville with an artist named Claire Kelly, who literally, it's like, that is the pinnacle of, this band is the most fun you can ever have playing with musicians. So anytime I get a call to play with that band, I'm like, even if I'm in Antarctica on a backpacking thing trying to find penguins, I will drop everything I'm doing and book it to Nashville to try to play with this band, because it's genuinely one of the most creatively fulfilling things. And that goes a long way.
Coming up on WTMJ Conversations.
I ended up playing, I think, 5 or 6 songs, and I didn't expect that going into it. And all of a sudden I was like pulling songs just like out of thin air, where I'm like, yeah, this could work.
Singer-songwriter Michael Murphy talks about auditioning for American Idol.
Now, more of WTMJ Conversations.
I'm Libby Collins. Today's conversation is with singer-songwriter Michael Murphy. Being creatively fulfilled is one thing.
Yes.
But you also have to make a living.
You also have to make a living.
You're only 24 years old. And your brother's a couple of years older.
Yeah.
He's also a musician. What are your parents saying about the sons that they've obviously invested quite a bit in, because they sent you to a great college, you've traveled. Do they ever say, when are you getting a real job, Michael?
No, fortunately not. It comes with a caveat. My mother sometimes will hint. She's like, well, sometimes it's just going to be nice to get like a 9-to-5. But then like she realized, I'm like, with how much I do in one day, you cannot balance a standard occupation. My brother has a system that's great because he has his teaching license. I mean, his undergrad is in music education, so he has a teaching license. So in New York, to make, because that city is its own level of expensive, astronomical level of expensive. And so he balances, if he's not on a contract, because he's been doing a pretty regular contract now with Ohio Light Opera in Worcester, and that's kind of takes up about 10 to 11 weeks in the summer. And so he has a system down where he has a subletter, because everyone's looking to sublease in New York all the time. It's like, it's a rotating door of performers coming in and out of contracts. And Nashville is the same. So he'll go to do this contract, and then if he's back and has a slow season, he'll substitute teach in the public schools, and then we'll go out on the road. But that's just like the way to, you know, keep the savings up. And it's the same. Like, I'll do, when I first moved to Nashville, I was working at a climbing gym. I was, you obviously, capital goes a long way. It's really hard to do anything if you don't have any money in your pocket. And so that's kind of why I've been in the utility man, say yes to as much as I can position, because it's like, I'm not paying so much on rent because I'm never in one spot at the same time. So it's like that, how you approach the fees and management of money to make it, especially as a young guy, it's like, it doesn't hurt yet. That's my philosophy on it. It's like, well, I could drive, like I just drove 5,500 miles in 2 weeks, and it doesn't hurt yet, is my philosophy. So I'm like, might as well keep saying yes to this stuff to keep it going. But
There are TV shows that give a lot of exposure to young aspiring musicians. The Voice, American Idol. Have you thought about trying to get on one of those shows?
Yeah, I actually, this would have been about a year ago, started doing auditions for Idol. And that was a really, really cool experience. I'm definitely in a spot where I would consider adding that and kind of diving in again to re-audition for stuff. I made it through, I think I did about two or three producer rounds. That one is like constant. It's because it is a show, you have this element of what are they looking for the season. And that's always what you get to battle with. And so at this particular time, my vocal characteristic and my style of artist was not necessarily what they needed in the scene.
And appearance has a lot to do with it, too.
It does, for sure. Yeah, and it's a very, very cool, very interesting audition experience. And so it's like, yeah, it's a lot of, you hop on a call and you talk and they interview you. And then you hop on another one and you're singing and playing. They're like, they tell you to prepare like two or three songs. I went in one of my auditions. I ended up playing, I think, five or six songs. So like, and I didn't expect that going into it. And all of a sudden I was like pulling songs in this time limit, just like out of thin air, where I'm like, ah, this could work. And so, yeah, in practice, then I could go back down and like pick a whole web of stuff to audition
with. So when they're talking about these open auditions, yeah, where people are lined up outside of places, is a lot of that already?
Yes. Oh my gosh. By the time you see people lined up, and especially with Idol and The Voice, they have gone through rounds and rounds of auditions. And actually, my John Holliday, the voice teacher that Jack and I both studied with, was on The Voice. And I remember he was like,
he went pretty far too.
He made it to, I think, top five.
Mm-hmm.
And which is great for his career because you have all the time of the live rounds of everything like that, doing all of the performances. And in his case, it's like he's primarily doing opera and classical voice. So he was there doing like pop jazz as a countertenor, and he's fine because then like he got off The Voice and I swear it was like 2 months later, all of a sudden it's like, hey, we're doing lessons remote because I'm in New York at the Metropolitan Opera. And the last time we all saw him was at the Metropolitan Opera. And it's like, yeah, that's the nature of stuff. Sometimes it's like it's really nice to manage the exposure. And you see a lot of that where people will go on stuff like that. It's the people that don't win that end up doing pretty good because you're not tied into the winning record contract where you have to do X amount of stuff. And you get the exposure you need. Like, I have a friend right now who's crushing it on America's Got Talent. And he has his whole story, and I actually just saw on social media that he just made a guest appearance on, I think, Good Morning America or the Today Show, because they had done a specialty segment on him, because one of the anchors like found his story super fascinating, so then they called him and they staged the surprise in the studio thing and did an interview of him. And I met him in Nashville, and for a while he was managing Claire, the artist I play with, so he was doing it. He's a video guy. He'll make music videos for his artists. He will help get them in contact with producers. But on the side, he's his own great singer-songwriter and artist and a phenomenal singer. And he was on a show that was, I'm totally forgetting the name of it, the Nashville Country Show that was short-lived, but it was like the next country star thing. And you'd go on and you'd sing. Apple Music was a sponsor of the show. So he was on that. And then that helped him boost a little bit more. And then now he's crushing it on America's Got Talent. So we'll see what ends up happening. Cause a lot of that too, it's like has been filmed. So you don't know what's, you know, but I've now been fortunate to be I have a good amount of close friends that have been on either The Voice, Idol, or America's Got Talent from the two cities that I tend to be in the most. And that's New York and Nashville. Like between that web of stuff, it's like, I kind of have understood for the audience. They do such a great job of masking the facade of like, wow, people stand in line forever. And some people do for some open calls, but now because of Zoom existing, it's like a lot of the pre-audition stuff, it's like they'll see thousands and thousands and thousands of people, and you won't sing to the judges until like 7 months after your first audition if you make it past like
the producers,
seven rounds.
Yeah.
You have to audition. And like I think I got seen by five different producers, and they're like, they run different breakout rooms, and you have like two hosting one thing, and then all of a sudden And the nice thing is you can audition multiple times for the same season because there's so many producers on the show that one could really like you and then outvote the other one that was like, yeah, couldn't make it past my breakout room. And then you never know. So there's definitely that in the future. It's worth my time doing it again. It's worth my social media presence doing it,
I think we're going to hear a lot more from you,
so.
Michael Murphy. And again, your debut solo project is called Indigo Jones. Thanks so much for being here with us.
This is so fun. Thank you for having me.
We've been talking with Michael Murphy. He's a singer-songwriter from Neenah, Wisconsin, who's moved his talents to Nashville. He's done a lot in his lifetime, including auditioning for American Idol. Now, if you joined us late and you want to hear our entire conversation with Michael, go to WTMJ.com and share today's show with your friends and family. You'll also find a partial transcript courtesy of eCourt Reporters. For WTMJ Conversations, I'm Libby Collins.